So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I first need to find my slide or have, very good. Shift gears a little bit. I represent a different sector, a stakeholder sector in the stem cell arena, and that is the biotech community. And I also represent a different technology platform, and that relates to adult stem cells. And the work that I'm going to show you will both represent some of our progress, but also some of the questions and some of the progress a little bit more broadly in the adherent stem cell space. So in that context, and hearing all of the exciting work to date with the ES and IPS populations, I have to tell you, I feel like a cat at a dog show. So I'm not able to advance that. He's going to show me the trick.
Another remote.
Ah, great. All right. So we are a publicly traded company. We're active in mid-phase clinical development. We have three clinical studies at phase two, a trial using the cells delivered by catheter in acute MI. We have two studies, we have two other phase two studies. One is using the cells as an infused product in patients with ischemic stroke. That's treatment of acute ischemic stroke. We also have a study that's partnered with the Pfizer Regenerative Medicine Group, and that's using the cells in ulcerative colitis. And we just recently closed a study in using the cells in GVHD prophylaxis in allogeneic bone marrow transplant, and we expect to continue that as a phase two study mid to third quarter next year. And so the adherent adult stem cells were originally thought to have strong regenerative potential, and I think we all understand that that's not proven true. And with the exception that these cells can form very valid connective or cardiovascular tissues ex vivo, when they're put in the body, they act primarily by through trophic impact on trophic pathways. They're secreting biologics that limit damage from the acute inflammatory response and stimulate repair, particularly in ischemic or acute injury. And so in that sense, the cells themselves, because they home to a site of injury, are actually like a biologics delivery vehicle, and they exert influence on multiple repair pathways simultaneously. And so that's actually proven to be quite useful. And so it was also understood that these cells have a very low immunogenic profile. They can be delivered to patients without patient matching. Their benefit does not require immunosuppression. They don't persist long-term, consistent with their action as a biologics delivery vehicle. And they also can be made in very large quantities from single or few donors. So when you think about it, this is really not a transplant-type cell therapeutic. This is a biologic or drug. And from the perspective of pharma or healthcare, it meets their expectations that you have a product that without patient matching requirements and ease of distribution, and you have something that can be made similar to a biologic at large scale. And so there's been a lot of capital that's come into this space to aid in mid-stage sort of valley of death survival in phase two and phase three. There's certainly been the investment by Genzyme in Osiris Therapeutics. We've had a relationship with Pfizer. I should have put Pluristem's relationship with United Therapeutics. And Cephalon has made a big investment in Mesoblast. And between Osiris and Mesoblast and other groups, not only are these studies in phase two, but many of these studies have progressed into phase three. And so because of that, I think Mahendra had mentioned earlier that there's very significant experience with this cell class globally. And there was a data report in 2010, a clinical data report on experience from over 100 trials in over 14 indications. About half of those were autologous, about half of those were allogeneic. There is a fairly good perspective with standards for how to produce the cells and how to release the cells in terms of lot release criteria. And global regulatory agencies view that this is a very safe cell class. There's been no evidence to date of any ectopic tissue or tumorigenicity risk, and there's been no evidence to date for infusional toxicity or immune sensitization. So I think the perspective in the field now is not around safety, but around understanding dosing and dose strategies to show efficacy. And I'd also point out that studies are going on globally. Again, this is a 2010 report. South America should have been represented on here. I'm not sure who's going to foster the first trial in Antarctica to have us covered completely globally, but eventually we'll see that. And I think we're also all aware that there's been a tremendous surge of clinical activity in Asia. So I'm going to use about a half a dozen slides and just show you a snapshot of some of our clinical data to date. What we've really done strategically is organize ourselves around how the cells act, around their anti-inflammatory or immunomodulatory activity, around their value in treating ischemic injury in a cardiovascular setting, or in a couple of neurological programs. And so this is some frontline data from our GVHD prophylaxis study. And so what we're doing here is delivering our cells at the time of allogeneic bone hematopoietic stem cell transplant. And the premise is that we can stop the initiation of T cells in the graft reacting to allogeneic antigens in the patient. And so we've done that by using two treatment arms. The first arm is a single dose escalation using 1, 5, or 10 million cells per kilogram. This is a day 2 post-transplant. Our repeat dosing arm has been using up to 5 repeat doses of 5 million cells per kilogram at a weekly interval through day 30. And so this really overlays the standard methotrexate treatment for GVHD prophylaxis and was the rationale for the repeat dosing that we had used. But we've had some very encouraging data. This is frontline data from the single dose arm only. And this is showing you the rates of grade 2, 4 GVHD in patients receiving either FK506 or cyclosporin as their GVHD prophylaxis regimen. So it runs at about 50%. And so this is the data we had out for grade 2, 4 responses in our single arm. And this is the frequency of grade 3, 4 that we've seen. And in fact, at our highest dose, this 10 million per kilogram, we had no incidence of grade 3, 4 GVHD response. And we had no safety, no increased frequencies of infection, and no increased frequency, if anything, less relapse represented. So we were able to use that data, primarily the biosafety data gained from the IV infusion approach, to go forward and directly into a phase 2 study in ulcerative colitis. And the other reason, in addition to biosafety, that we took that step is that we also understood how our cells were acting in terms of immunomodulation. We have a series of in vitro and in vivo studies that show that we dampen the IL-6 TNF-alpha interferon gamma inflammatory response. We up-induce IL-10 and TGF-beta suppressive responses, and we actively induce T regulatory populations that reset an autoimmune or an allogeneic immune rejection response. And this is just data from our GVHD study in a preclinical model showing you the colon of an animal treated with PBS, but with active disease, and you can see all the hemorrhagic lesions that are there. This is what we see in animals with the stem cell treatment arm itself. So I have a couple of slides on our clinical data from the AMI study. As I mentioned, we're delivering the cells by catheter, and it's actually a rather novel catheter-based delivery approach. We use a balloon occlusion catheter that, when inflated, pokes a needle through the side of the LAD and distributes cells into the adventitious layer surrounding the vessel. And so they may be distributed here. We've tracked in our pig preclinical studies that they actively migrate through the heart parenchyma and associate in the peri-infarct zone in the peri-infarct zone around the ischemic injury. And this is just one of, I think, our first patient delivery. This is showing the occluded balloon. This is contrast dye as cells are occluded out into the adventitious tissue layer. And then this is a reflow angiogram, just showing that we've had no issues with mechanical dissection of the vessel. And so this is some of our frontline data there. This is actually data that includes response data out past 12 months. This is looking at a registry group that we had on study as our control population. We had three different doses, 20, 50, and 100 million. We get a trend towards a dose response, and if anything, a plateau at this range. But this is improvement in ejection fraction at 4 months after delivery. So you can see this is in patients with initial EFs around 30 to 45, so significantly depressed, and we get a very strong response. And then if you compare the blue to the purple bars here, you can see that that response is durable and maintained out to 12 months. Oops. So we're also very active, as I mentioned, in the CNS space. We have an open phase 2 study enrolling patients in stroke. These are patients that have had stroke and are treated 1 to 2 days after presentation. It's primarily safety shifting to an efficacy study. We have two dose tiers, as indicated here. We go through two cohorts and then choose best response and go forward with 60 treated, 60 placebo. So we're trying to get some significant response in a more well-powered study here. We're obviously looking at safety, no evidence of neurological worsening, and then we have a combination of functional outcomes, but also an imaging-driven evaluation of infarct size and spleen size. And so that was staged by a series of preclinical experiments. It's been published, and you guys can take a look. We did a lot of work to understand that we had no requirement for immune suppression. We did a lot of work to do dose titrations, and we found that there are dose thresholds that don't hold the durable response and a dose threshold that does hold durable response, and that was the basis for selection of our clinical dosing strategy. So I want to take three slides and just step back up from our data and talk about some really sort of technology gaps that are necessary for us to advance clinically. And in this sense, these are things that are common to both ES or adult or tissue-specific stem cell clinical development requirements. And again, because we're active in phase two and moving to phase three, you know, our concerns are much more around commercializing the product and bringing it into standard of care. And so some of our emphasis is really driven around, can you make enough, and can you make enough economically that you're able to produce product to meet large trial needs? And the fact that it has to be economic is something that's been very critical and exampled by the recent Dendreon experience, where it's very clear that the price for therapy was not embraced by the physician practicers, and it doesn't appear that FDA approval by itself is going to guarantee that you're going to see this move into an accepted practice. And then the thing that this audience may be a little bit less cognizant of is there really is not a technology hardware platform out there to make enough cells to meet commercial needs. And instead of going through flasks or small cell factories, we've got to get out into bioreactors and suspension-based culture protocols. So one of the other things that's happening is that trials are moving out to physician centers. So they're not just being practiced in hematology stem cell centers. And so you don't have the ability to process the cell product. You have to provide the cells in a formulation that allows a physician's assistant to just thaw and directly deliver and infuse, or you've got to have the ability to store the product at the physician centers in non-liquid nitrogen-based storage. You know, you have to design your system at the beginning for the physician center and experience they have, and you have to design your formulation and your cell densities to be user-friendly for the cath labs, and is what we've just seen with the spinal cord project, very complex neurosurgeries. And so finally, you know, we'll go back to some of the other things that are vitally needed here, and I think it reflects a sort of a rush to proof of concept clinically in the adherent stem cell space. We've moved very quickly through our phase two trial requirements and have launched into phase three studies, perhaps without understanding well enough how to best design our dose regimens. And it reflects a failure to really define PK-PD relationships and in preclinical studies to have done sufficient dose-response treatments. In our early clinical studies, there's often been a lack of a systematic and wide dynamic range dose ranging to best understand how many cells are necessary in terms of a critical threshold. Clearly a need to track donor cells, but not only do we need to know how long they persist, we need to know how long they have to be there for the required benefit. Cell persistence long-term may not be linked to patient recovery at all. In that sense, we really need biomarkers to tell us when the efficacy of the cells has dropped off. And then finally, we really need to drive industry and all of us in the adherent stem cell space to create standardized potency benchmarks. I think one thing that was mentioned a little bit earlier is the physician is going to receive a bag of cells from a company, and it's going to say an adherent stem cell product. There's nothing like the label on the back of a soup can that tells you what the potency is and what the potency is along different mechanistic pathways. And there isn't a way for a physician to understand which company's cell product is advantageous over another's. And there's got to be a way we can bring that kind of testing into an early phase in clinical development and not leave it for post-market approval. And so with that, I say thank you and look forward to the rest of the meeting.